Welcome to Striving for Consensus, Optimizing the Current and Future Management of Patients with Biliary Tract Cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I sat down with four clinical investigators, Drs. Lipika Goyal, James Harding, Milan Javle, and Robin Katie Kelly for a think tank discussion on relevant data sets and perspectives on the current and future management of patients with biliary tract cancers. To begin, Dr. Kelly reviewed the role of immunotherapy in advanced disease.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Neil and RTP. My talk today will be on the current role of immunotherapeutic strategies in advanced biliary tract cancers, for which I'll use the acronym BTC. So here's a quick outline. I'll go over some background and biologic rationale for combining immunotherapy with chemotherapy in particular, and then delve into the outcomes for chemotherapy and immunotherapy in combination, focusing largely on the pivotal phase 3 trial data from two big trials, TOPAZ-1 and KEYNOTE-966. And then, of course, conclude with some future directions and other thoughts. So by way of background, the cholangiocarcinoma immune microenvironment is very heterogeneous and predominantly cold with respect to its immune components. Immune profiling of cholangiocarcinoma show that only a subset, around 10%, have immunogenic features or an immune infiltrate suggestive of immune response. And there are pretty low rates of PD-L1 positivity or high tumor mutational burdens. A small fraction, around 2%, do have high microsatellite instability scores or mismatch repair, and those patients do benefit exquisitely from immunotherapy. But again, in the 98% of patients that don't have that, immunotherapy has a relatively low objective response rate, less than 10% across drugs, including pembrolizumab, nivolumab, durvalumab, and other studies. So for that reason, checkpoint inhibitors as monotherapy don't have a role in this disease. Now, there are some reasons to suspect that immune checkpoint inhibitors combined with chemotherapy could augment an immune response, particularly for gemcitabine and cisplatin, which is our chemotherapy backbone in biliary tract cancers. And there are a host of different ways this might happen, including that cytotoxicity can elicit pro-inflammatory cytokines that promote an immune response. Immune cell infiltration can be triggered, particularly through the mechanism of action of cisplatin, which causes ferroptosis and is particularly pro-immune cell infiltration. Sometimes chemotherapies can inhibit regulatory elements of the immune microenvironment. And of course, cytotoxicity to some degree can increase tumor immunogenicity by causing release of tumor-associated antigens, or in the case of gemcitabine, promoting MHC1 expression and presentation. So those are the rationales for studying immunotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors in particular in combination with gemcitabine and cisplatin. And so now I'll turn to the pivotal data in this area, beginning with the TOPAZ-1 trial. The study design of TOPAZ-1 is shown here. This was an international randomized phase 3 trial of patients with locally advanced or metastatic biliary tract cancers with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and gallbladder cancer shown here. All patients were treatment naive for their metastatic or advanced disease, and they were stratified on resectable status and primary tumor location. 685 patients were randomized to either durvalumab plus gemcis or placebo plus gemcis. And it's important to note that patients received the treatment arm triplet combination for up to 8 cycles every 3 weeks, which is 6 months. And then after that, patients received just durvalumab or placebo as maintenance for patients who were still either stable disease or responding on treatment. The primary objective was overall survival. So here is the primary efficacy endpoint, overall survival, for the combination, favoring the durvalumab arm in red. This is the 4-year overall survival data presented by Dr. Oh in Lancet Gastroenterology Hepatology this year, showing that gemcis plus durvalumab in the red curve improved overall survival, as well as secondary endpoints of progression-free survival and objective response rate over gemcitabine, cisplatin, and placebo. And when we look at these data, we see very encouragingly a separation of the curves that is somewhat prolonged over time and accentuates with prolonged follow-up, suggesting an immune response which is durable. If we look at patients with objective responses here in the bottom right, we see that the purple curve is quite distinct from the orange curve, showing that patients with response on gemcis plus durva had a much longer duration of response, suggesting again that these are true immunologic-mediated responses. His safety in both arms was quite similar. And just looking at this on high, we see that the serious adverse event rates were almost identical in both arms, as were the treatment-related adverse events. Immune-related adverse events occurred in 12.7% for the durvalumab arm, as expected, versus 4.7% for placebo. But most of these were grade 1 and 2, and only 2.4% were grade 3 or 4. So very encouraging safety. When we look at key subgroups, we see that the vast majority of pre-planned sub-analyses fall to the left of this line of equipoise, suggesting that most clinically relevant subgroups benefited from the addition of durvalumab, including those with or without PD-L1 expression. So tumor PD-L1 is not a discerning factor for who's going to respond. Intrahepatic, extrahepatic, and gallbladder all trended towards benefit, greatest for intrahepatic in this study. And when we look at regions of the world, according to anatomic subsite, we see that Asia and Europe versus other parts of the world were also pretty similar, all trending in the same direction towards benefit without any outliers. A really important aspect of the TOPAZ-1 study are the biomarker data sets, which we hope will help us identify different combinations to study down the road in different subgroups. Among 441 patients in the overall study of 685, tumor molecular profiling data were available using Foundation 1 profiling. Here we can see the overall spread of different mutations ranging from P53 and almost 50% to much rarer, such as FGFR2 fusions down only at 3.4% in this population. And if we look at how those patients performed according to mutation subset, we see that most patients had pretty similar benefit to the overall population, trending to the left of the line of equipoise here, with a couple exceptions that were slight outliers. Again, really small data sets for these mutation subgroups, but we see that, for example, in ARID1A, there's a slight trend towards benefit with favoring GemCis with placebo, less benefit with the Durva in the altered ARID1A, likewise for CDKN2A and ERBB2 amplifications. When we look at response rate, we see a somewhat similar trend for IDH1, where patients with IDH1 mutation seem to have a better response rate in the placebo arm rather than the Durva arm. These are extremely small numbers, but also show us that there could be some differences in our hypothesis generating at the minimum to let us know to look more carefully at these data. So turning to the next pivotal study in this field, KEYNOTE-966 was a very similar study, a large randomized phase 3 trial, looking at a different combination of gemcitabine cisplatin with pembrolizumab instead of durvalumab versus gemcis plus placebo. Again, the primary endpoint was overall survival. And one key point that was different between this study and TOPAZ-1 was that instead of stopping the chemotherapy entirely after 6 months or 8 cycles, the gemcitabine was allowed to be continued without a set maximum beyond the 6-month mark into the maintenance setting, according to investigator discretion and patient factors in terms of how they were feeling, what their blood counts were, and how the tumor was responding. So patients continued in the majority of cases on gemcitabine beyond the 6-month mark, in addition to either pembrolizumab or placebo. So a very significant difference in the design there. The patient populations were slightly different in that there was a lower proportion Asian, higher proportion Western in the KEYNOTE-966 trial compared to TOPAZ, just for reference. But again, both trials were predominantly intrahepatic. Looking at the survival curves for the primary endpoint, KEYNOTE-966, like TOPAZ-1, showed significant improvement in median overall survival for the combination with pembrolizumab compared to placebo, with a median 12.7 versus 10.9 months, including at key landmarks of 12 and 24 months. We don't see quite as definitive separation of the curves, but this is where it's important to remember that patients in the placebo arm were more often receiving gemcitabine in the study, whereas in the TOPAZ-1 arm, gemcitabine had discontinued, so all patients were really just on placebo at that point. So design differences may have played a role. Pre-specified subgroups, again, showed benefit similar to the overall population according to geographic region, race and ethnicity. Anatomic subsite showed, again, a similar favoring of intrahepatic with slightly less differential benefit for extrahepatic and gallbladder, but these were pretty small subgroups. Hard to interpret in the setting of the comorbidities in those subgroups in particular as a potential explanation for why they're less clear-cut. There wasn't a clear-cut difference in objective response rate in KEYNOTE-966 according to addition of pembrolizumab versus placebo, but the duration of response, again, was much longer in the green curve here for the patients who received pembro compared to those who received placebo in the purple, both at the interim and final analyses, just like TOPAZ-1, again, reinforcing the idea that these patients in the green curve getting the checkpoint inhibitor were having a longer and more durable response due to the immunotherapy. Like TOPAZ-1, there was no significant difference in high-grade adverse events, and overall the treatment combination with pembro had very similar safety to placebo plus chemo. So in conclusion, the addition of an anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 immune checkpoint, either pembrolizumab or durvalumab, to standard GEM plus CIS chemotherapy improves survival in the first-line setting for advanced biliary tract cancers. The overall survival improvements from both of these studies are admittedly modest, but the patients who do have responses and prolonged survival seem to have much more durable responses, and there is a tail of the curve, particularly in the TOPAZ trial. This benefit does appear independent of whether GEM is stopped after 6 months versus continued at maintenance, so I think it applies to both of those practice patterns and patient contexts. And overall, the overall survival improvement was pretty consistent across geographic and molecular subgroups, though there were a few outliers that I hope will help us design future studies and future analyses to determine if there may be a better strategy. Those are particularly the ERBB2 amplification patients and perhaps IDH1, though again, the data are really limited by the small sample size. The subgroup analyses by an anatomic site do suggest a greater benefit in intrahepatic, particularly for KEYNOTE-966, but also trending that way for TOPAZ-1. But here it's very difficult to interpret because the sample sizes are small and these patients with extrahepatic and gallbladder do have more competing comorbidity that can particularly confound overall survival. Both studies show very resoundingly that the addition of a checkpoint inhibitor to GEMCIS had very acceptable safety without key worsening of any of the key safety parameters. And the strength of these data and the symmetry of the data have led to regulatory approvals for GEMCIS plus durvalumab, as well as GEMCIS plus pembrolizumab since their publications. And a key thing on the horizon is how will ongoing studies inform us regarding the role of combination with immune checkpoint inhibitors and other chemotherapies. And I'll end with showing a trial that's ongoing called the Tourmaline study. This is a phase 3B multicenter international study looking at other first-line chemotherapy backbones combined with durvalumab, given that not all patients receive GEMCIS for various reasons, including renal function or other comorbidities. So this is looking at gemcitabine monotherapy, GEMCIS or gemcitabine with oxaliplatin, gemcitabine with carboplatin, et cetera, or gemcitabine plus S1, for example, all combined with durvalumab, and then looking at both safety as well as efficacy endpoints. So this will help us know if we can extrapolate from the TOPAZ-1 and 966 studies to other first-line chemo backbones or at least gem-based backbones. So with that, I will conclude the talk and proceed to discussing several cases, and I'm hoping I might get some input from my colleagues on these real-world cases. The first is a patient that I've been taking care of for many years with a distal cholangiocarcinoma who ended up getting treated with the TOPAZ-1 regimen. This patient is a 67-year-old Chinese-American male, no viral hepatitis. In 2020, he had a hepaticojejunostomy and extrahepatic bile duct resection showing a T2 moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma with KRAS mutation and an ATM mutation. In particular, it was HER2 negative. We test HER2 in all of our patients now. I treated him with adjuvant capecitabine. And for about the next 2 years, he did quite well. But unfortunately, in 2022, he started on surveillance imaging in labs. He showed a CA19-9 elevation, prompting us to get, in addition to his regular CT scans, we got a PET scan and unfortunately found some peritoneal metastases that didn't show up very well on the original CTs. We got an EUS biopsy, which confirmed recurrent adenocarcinoma. And so I started him on the regimen established by TOPAZ-1 with gemcitabine, cisplatin, and durvalumab. He did quite well, but had a little bit of a rash for a while, but eventually achieved a complete response. And so at that point, I stopped therapy. That was after about eight cycles or 6 months exactly, and switched him to just maintenance durvalumab. And so maybe I'll pause there and ask my colleagues, would you guys go to durvalumab monotherapy as maintenance, or would you have continued the gemcitabine in someone like this? I'll start with, how about Lipica?
Yeah, sure. You know, as you beautifully presented, because in TOPAZ-1, we stopped the gemcitabine overall and continued with durvalumab alone, given that he had a complete response, especially and we want to minimize toxicity, maintenance with durvalumab would be the way to go in my mind.
Yeah, I think that's exactly how I was feeling. Perhaps if he had had bulky residual disease, I would have continued. But given that there was nothing measurable at that point, his CA19-9 had normalized, we stopped and just continued durvalumab alone. And then at that point, he continued on durvalumab for 7 months. So he got a chemo-free interval. His blood counts recovered. He went on several trips with his partner to Asia, including, you know, pretty big life change being off chemo for him. Unfortunately, after 7 months, he did progress and needed to go on a second-line clinical trial. So that's the first case I wanted to share. The next case is a patient with recurrent gallbladder cancer who had a complication of biliary obstruction. She's a somewhat similar patient who had, instead of distal cholangio, she had a cholecystectomy and was incidentally found to have gallbladder cancer leading to a radical resection, PT2 tumor. She also got adjuvant capecitabine after surgery for 6 months. And then 2 years later, she developed new biliary obstruction, and it was very difficult to see a tumor, but ERCP showed a really long stricture, and biopsy confirmed that, unfortunately, she had sort of an infiltrative tumor growing up the common bile duct that was causing a long malignant stricture. So she required stenting. It was unresectable due to the extent of it and her prior gallbladder surgery. So I also put her on the gemcitabine, cisplatin, durvalumab, TOPAZ-1 regimen. Unfortunately, she had a really rocky course for the first 5 months and required a lot of breaks in the gemcitabine and cisplatin. She was in and out of the hospital. But this is where I wanted to highlight this potential for using durvalumab during those breaks in therapy. And so maybe I'll ask Milind if you have cases like this. I actually found it very helpful to be able to stop her chemo, treat with antibiotics, but continue the durva while she's getting her ERCPs and antibiotics and not have a full break. Have you had patients like this where you've continued immune checkpoint inhibitor mid-treatment?
Edie, I think you illustrate very well that when you have biliary obstruction from cholangiocarcinoma or gallbladder cancer, you deal with two diseases. One is the biliary obstruction, which is often the cause of mortality, even not just the cancer. So I haven't personally used durvalumab as maintenance, but I found that sometimes it's really a good biliary drainage. And I find, especially if the obstruction is above the bifurcation, that I prefer PTCs in that setting with lower risk of infection. Patients who have recurrent obstruction, we have now a trial of prophylactic antibiotics given in a lower dosage along with ursodiol. But absolutely, it's a real challenge. And I think what you point out may be a direction that perhaps you can do immunotherapy or checkpoint inhibitors as a maintenance therapy.
Thanks. That's great advice about key points about the drainage. You need a multidisciplinary team and experts to help with these patients. But in this patient's case, she eventually completed 6 months of gemcitabine and cisplatin with the durvalumab, but with lots of breaks in the chemo when she was infected, and then transitioned to durvalumab maintenance. She ended up having over 10-month chemo-free interval and was able to travel and have a pretty normal life. Unfortunately, now at the end of that 10 to 11 months, she's starting to have a rising CA19-9. This is her most recent MRI from this month, which shows a really ill-defined but present tumor that's causing the obstruction to worsen. So unfortunately, I think we'll have to restart chemotherapy. But she's an example of how the regimen can work in these complex obstructed patients. And with that, I'll say thanks for having me and thanks for your attention. Oh, go ahead, Milind.
Yeah, Milind, you had a thought or question?
Yes, I had a question for you, Katie, and really for the group. What is your strategy for reusing GemCis after patients have received prior gemcitabine, cisplatin, and durvalumab in the past?
So that's a great question. Oh, I was just going to answer for this patient because I was having that same thought in mind because it's been 10 months since her last gemcitabine, cisplatin, and so I was going to talk with her about the option of rechallenging versus switching to FOLFOX. We'll probably rechallenge first since it's been more than 6 months and she did so well on GemCis previously. But great question, Lippy.
Yeah, I would say I think about it very similarly. I think about what is the interval between when we stop the gemcis and when the patient has progression on durvalumab alone. And if it's, you know, more than 3 to 6 months, then I think about rechallenging with gemcis, especially if they had a nice response initially. And then I think, what are my plan B options? Does the patient have an FGFR2 fusion, IDH1 mutation, a BRAF mutation, HER2 amplification? Then do I have a clinical trial of option availability? That helps me think about what to do for plan B, because I feel like we can always come back to gemcis and durva or gemcis and pembro in the future as needed.
So maybe I can add in a couple other questions before we go to the next talk. You mentioned the ATM in this patient, and I noticed that, I know there are very, very few patients there, but you had BRCA as one of the biomarkers that you looked at. Can you comment a little bit of what was seen? I know it was a very small number of patients, and what in general you expect to see in a patient who has like a BRCA germline mutation. And I guess occasionally you must have that. In terms of, first of all, response to, you know, chemotherapy, and second of all, benefit of adding IO, Katie?
That's a great question. So the TOPAZ-1 biomarker data showed that about 4% or so of patients had a BRCA mutation, if I remember the numbers right. We don't know which of those were germline versus tumor. But if we look to other data sets, say from Tempus profiling, we can see that probably about 5 or 6% of patients will have tumor or germline, somatic or germline BRCA1. And overall, if you look at HRD, homologous recombination repair defect mutations, about 13 to 15% of biliary tract cancer patients, depending on the population, will have one of these mutations, including ATM, PALB2, FINK1, RAD51. Mutations that may correlate with a response to PARP inhibitors also tend to have slightly higher TMBs. In the TOPAZ-1 biomarker data set, the patients with BRCA1 or 2 mutations actually had the highest response rate, substantially higher response rate than the overall population, suggesting potentially a greater response to the platinum component or the immunotherapy plus platinum. But those patients do tend to do better based on at least the response rate in the TOPAZ-1 trial.
And Jim, picking up on the point there that Katie was talking about in terms of intrahepatic, the potential that maybe patients respond better to IOs. Any thoughts about whether that's true? And if so, why?
Yeah, that's a great question. I still think that, you know, anatomic site with regard to response to IO remains unclear. These are subsets on these studies. The, sub-analysis suggests some benefit. I don't particularly feel strongly that we have that answer yet. It's an important question, and currently efforts are ongoing to profile the immune milieu and all of these, and I think that will be something to look for in the future.
So Lippi, Katie was talking about other chemotherapy IO combinations that are being studied in trial. I'm curious right now what your thoughts are about that. What do you think ideally would be the best combination?
Yeah, I'm so glad that trial is going on because, as Katie mentioned, some patients are not candidates for cisplatin due to renal failure or for other reasons. And certainly in other countries, we use gemcitabine and S1. And so it'll be great to see what the addition of durvalumab or pembrolizumab does in those cases, because we want to make this to be a universally and globally accepted standard. And the other question that sometimes comes up in my practice is people who historically got gemcitabine and cisplatin before the TOPAZ-1 and KEYNOTE-966 studies were positive, they now ask me, Dr. Goyal, should I do FOLFOX plus pembrolizumab, or should I do second-line chemotherapy? Yeah, and so I don't have the answer for them. You know, I'm curious to my friends here on the call, what people think about that.
I think it's a great question, and I don't think we really know the answer. I think in some ways we're bound to by insurer and the data. So I found it hard, for example, to give FOLFOX and Nevo or a Durva Pembro. Their data, of course, for FOLFOX with a number of anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies indicating safety and efficacy. But in the cholangio space, I found that hard in the clinical perspective to do that and to justify it. So I think this study is quite important, as noted, to do that. Honestly, I've actually rechallenged people with Gemcitabine or Pembro, which is, I don't think, unreasonable if there's been a long time frame from it. And, you know, I think that that's reasonable. Or look for a study in the later line with IO.
So before, one more question before we go on to the next talk, coming back to you, Malin, can you talk a little bit more about the study that you were mentioning on prophylactic antibiotics and what you recommend outside a trial?
So there's a long history of prophylactic antibiotics in oncology. Neil, we have in leukemia, we use prophylactic antibiotics. In patients who have HIV, we use prophylactic antibiotics. Unfortunately, this disease is an orphan amongst orphans, and the traditional teaching is you treat them with 10 days of antibiotics and then you stop. Well, the fact is these ducts are only partially drained. They are colonized, and you give them gemcitabine and cisplatin, they're going to get myelosuppressed and reactivate. So we've had patients who, you know, get admitted two or three times a month. And I cannot fathom why we do not consider prophylactic antibiotics. So I reviewed the literature, and there was older literature with older, you know, antibiotics used in subtherapeutic doses. So, I've started doing that. Fluoroquinolones are used, for instance, in leukemia in a little lower than the traditional dose. For instance, levofloxacin is used at 500 milligrams daily instead of 750. People are on that for years in cases of leukemia. So we started doing that, incorporated that in our practice guideline at our institution, because you can't really do a trial, but defined which patients we would include. So we defined a certain number of admissions per month, and requiring certain number of biliary stent exchanges per month. And I would certainly hesitate to prescribe this. This is not prescriptive, what I'm discussing. But we have found that has certainly decreased our hospital readmission rate. What long-term implication it will have on antibiotic resistance, etc., I do not know. But as I mentioned, we use that in other settings in oncology, and this setting we use is just as lethal. And I think there are certain situations where we should consider it.
I agree with Milind. It's a really important area, but difficult to study. And I would just say, while we always want to give antibiotics, as Milind alluded to, it's something to be undertaken with caution, because, you know, we have seen patients get to resistance. It's terminal resistance of their bacterial species with prolonged, or, you know, I've had a Achilles rupture from a prolonged fluoroquinolone patient. What we do with ID is exactly like Milind said, if we see someone who's recurringly admitted with a certain tempo of accelerating infections, we usually, our infectious disease colleagues with whom I work, you need a team with someone you know who knows your patients, your population, will do a pill and pocket a strategy to start. Well, they'll give patients a dual, you know, Cipro and Flagyl to have at home when they get their first fever, so that they can then come in and get cultured and have stay out of the ER. And then if that fails, they'll go on suppressive. But it is a tricky place.
And I do also think, just one last thing, and Milind had mentioned this, that the initial biliary drainage and how one goes about doing that, I think, is really critically important. Very reflexively, when you see biliary obstruction, you know, people view that as almost an emergency and let's go to do an ERCP. That may not be necessarily appropriate. I really favor DMT review, IR review, surgical review, especially with initial biliary drainage if that's required, because the location may have a more favorable approach, like percutaneous cholangiogram and stenting over ERCP.
These are really tremendously helpful comments. Lippy?
Yeah, I was wondering if I could ask a question about what our colleagues do in patients who have HER2 amplified biliary tract cancers in the front line. I thought the data that Dr. Kelly presented was really interesting from the TOPAZ-1 study around the patients with HER2 amplification. Potentially, they did better in the gemcitabine cisplatin arm. And of course, you know, small subsets and, you know, need to do it in bigger trials. but there are certainly some data with gemcitabine, cisplatin, trastuzumab, that look promising, mainly from patients with gallbladder cancer, but the study from India. And I'm curious, and, you know, everyone on this call is my friend, and so I've certainly emailed several of you in the past about what you do in frontline. And I'm curious, would you favor gemcitabine cisplatin IO or gemcitabine cisplatin HER2 inhibitor for patients in the front line?
How about I'll ask Melinda to respond, but what about upper GI and just go with both, chemo, IO, and anti-HER? Milan?
So I think, Lippi, this is an area that has been of interest to really all of us in the group, in the chat here. And so there is, as you know, an ongoing study that has just been activated. Two studies, actually. One from that includes trastuzumab deruxtecan, and the other with zanidatamab, which are randomized studies, which will include either of those agents along with immunotherapy versus systemic chemotherapy, so versus standard of care. So that will hopefully answer the question. While these studies were not available, or not in some centers the trial is not open, I do consider adding trastuzumab first line to gemcitabine cisplatin and durvalumab or pembrolizumab for HER2/3+, particularly with gallbladder cancer. I think the data in the second line setting are provocative, and I certainly agree with those who want to wait until the second line setting to initiate those drugs. But if they're approved, I do use them first line.
So we're going to move on to the next topic, but let me just tell you, listening to some of the things that you just said, I thought about something else I want to put in your head. We're going to ask you later, which is some of the myths and misperceptions. I'm not going to say errors you see, but remember, our audience does not see the volume of BTCs that you all do. So these things about prophylactic antibiotics, stents, et cetera, if you have any pet things that you've observed in people getting referred to you, we're going to do a little section on that somewhere along the way. So just keep that in mind, like sort of things that maybe you see people doing that maybe make mistakes. So I want to use that term, maybe myths or misperceptions.
Neil, I would love to talk about it. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? All right. Something must have popped into your head. So go ahead and tell us.
Neil, I would say the management of biliary tract cancer is multidisciplinary. And unfortunately, I see patients get PTCs, drains, draining into a bag, and land straight up in the ICU or in our ER with dehydration. So there are aspects to this care which should be managed in a large tertiary cancer center, such as early capping of the stews, making sure that patients get hydrated, patients get warned about infections, get pocket antibiotics, like Katie mentioned, because unfortunately these patients, a large number of them die from complications from inadequate biliary plumbing.
That's such a great point. I'll come back to you, Lippi. Any thoughts about that? What should an oncologist think to themselves in terms of what they need in terms of surgical support, IR support, pathology, et cetera, in order to be able to take care of these people as opposed to referring them out?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really a luxury to be at a center with excellent specialists in all these different fields. We bring a lot of patients to tumor boards because, as Melinda is saying, it's really important to get everybody's input. So I have a lot of my colleagues in surgery and pathology and I are on speed dial on my phone because we all text each other about these patients. But certainly getting multidisciplinary input, whether it's in a tumor board or informally, is very helpful.
And I got to say, and Jim, you know, we were commenting on how we in CME were able to do so much more now because of, you know, telecommunications. I got to say, I'm kind of disappointed that we haven't seen, you know, sort of telemedicine come in stronger into clinical medicine, including oncology. To me, these kind of situations would be great for a virtual second opinion. Maybe they don't have a great IR person there, or a hepatologist or whatever. Any thoughts about whether or not we could kind of do better? I'm not sure exactly what goes on in some of the major institutions in terms of being able to work with some of these community-based practices.
Yeah, well, I think there are efforts and many ongoing studies looking at the appropriate utilization of telemedicine, decentralization of clinical trials as well, that I do think may have an impact in the way we treat patients in the future. With regard to sort of biliary tract cancers, you know, I do offer telemed, and I'm, as we all do, it is sometimes very helpful, I think, with the complexity of the management, though, to see patients too. I think it's an important aspect of the care. It is hard sometimes to judge performance status in a distant way and to make clear recommendations. But I do think like hotline essentially to a multidisciplinary management team makes sense. And I think we will see more of that in the advent of this digital world.
So let's move on now, and Lippy's going to talk about FGFR and IDH1. So the other night, Tony did the old, is biliary tract cancer the new non-small cell lung cancer? And we at RTP claim that, because I think we were the first to ever say that about 5 years ago, but you probably all were saying that before anyhow. But it is really wild how this has evolved, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But let's jump into these two particular alterations. Lippy, take it away.
Great. Thank you, Neil. Yeah, as you said, you know, it's great to have all these different targets now in cholangiocarcinoma. As Katie mentioned, there's intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and gallbladder cancer that are all biliary tract cancers. And we used to treat them all together with the same regimen with chemotherapy. And now with the advent of next generation sequencing, we're able to bucket patients a little bit differently by their molecular subtypes. And so, as you mentioned, I'll focus on FGFR2 fusions and IDH1 mutations, two of the most common alterations in cholangiocarcinoma. So with next-generation sequencing, we see a lot of different targets that are actionable in cholangiocarcinoma. Here is a nice review by Angela LaMarca, where we see in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, we see FGFR2 alterations in 15 to 20% of patients, IDH1 mutations in about 15 to 20% of patients, and a smattering of other alterations. And with the progress we've made with different sequencing techniques, we're now seeing more targets. And with lots of drug development, we're seeing drugs be available for targets that we had known about in the future, but weren't able to target previously. So now, you know, we're going to hear about HER2 targeted therapies. We're going to hear about MDM2 targeted therapies. So there are a lot of new actionable targets in cholangiocarcinoma, which is exciting for our patients. Dr. Kelly spoke about two of these buckets that we think about as systemic therapy for cholangiocarcinoma. She spoke about cytotoxic chemotherapy combined with immunotherapy in the front line. I'm going to focus on targeted therapy, specifically for FGFR2 and IDH1. But there are a series of other alterations that we have drugs for, including BRAF V600E mutations, HER2 amplification and overexpression, NTRK fusions, RET fusions, and now, excitingly, KRAS G12C as well. Before I go into FGFR2 and IDH1, I just want to briefly talk about detecting these alterations. We certainly do use biopsies and use tumor tissue to do sequencing, but a new technology over the last decade, I would say, is looking at liquid biopsy or circulating tumor DNA for detection of FGFR2 fusions and IDH1 mutations. This was a multidisciplinary study that was done looking at the Guardant 360 assay, and this showed that about 44% of patients that had biliary tract cancer and had Guardant 360 had a detectable actionable alteration. We specifically looked at the concordance for IDH1 mutations and FGFR2 fusions, and liquid biopsy was very good at being able to detect point mutations in IDH1 with an 87% detection rate when compared to tissue. With FGFR2 fusions, there was not as good of a performance. We found that 18% of FGFR2 fusions were detected, and specifically the FGFR2 BIC1 fusions were detected well, but the other fusion partners were not detected well. This technology is continuing to improve, both with the Guardant 360 assay and with other liquid biopsy assays, and some assays detect FGFR2 fusions at a rate of over 80 to 90%. So this technology can be really helpful in patients with biliary tract cancer, because in up to 10 to 20% of patients, tissue profiling can fail because these tumors can be necrotic and we just don't have enough tumor content. So let's talk about FGFR signaling. The signaling is through the different FGFRs. There are four different receptor tyrosine kinases, FGFR 1 through 4. And these are really important in physiological processes such as angiogenesis, growth, healing. And it's a good system for cancer cells to hijack because they're pretty ubiquitous. And we detect the FGFR alterations, as mentioned, through tissue next generation sequencing, and also FISH is another way that we can detect these alterations. So we have two FDA-approved FGFR inhibitors for FGFR2 fusion or rearrangement positive cholangiocarcinoma. You know, we have fusions, rearrangements, we have mutations, and we have amplifications. And it's really the fusions and rearrangements that are the most sensitive to this class of drugs. So the first drug to ever get FDA-approved in cholangiocarcinoma was pemigatinib, and it was for this population. This is a reversible FGFR 1 through 3 inhibitor with weak inhibition of FGFR4. The response rate with this drug in this population was 36%, and you can see the progression-free survival was 6.9 months, and duration of response was 9.1 months. There's a second drug that got approved a couple of years later. The first one was in 2020. This one was in 2022. Futibatinib is an irreversible FGFR 1 through 4 inhibitor. So the way I describe it to my patients is that it's like a pit bull. It binds to the receptor and doesn't let go because it covalently bonds to the cysteine residue of the P loop. This one had a response rate of 42% in a trial, and the median progression-free survival was 9 months. Median duration of response was 9.7 months. I'll dig a little bit deeper into the two trials that led to the FDA approval of these two drugs. So the first is the FIGHT 202 study for pemigatinib. This had three arms. In cohort A, it had the patients with cholangiocarcinoma that had FGFR2 fusions and rearrangements. Cohort B had other FGF and FGFR genetic alterations, and cohort C had no FGF and FGFR alterations. This was in patients who had already progressed on one line of therapy, and they all got pemigatinib for 13.5 milligrams 2 weeks on and 1 week off. And this showed that in the patients in particular who had the FGFR2 fusions, you can see the nice waterfall plot here, which is just wasn't previously seen in any second line therapy before. With FOLFOX, we know the response rate is around 5%. So this was an impressive waterfall plot. You can see in the three different cohorts, when you look at the median progression-free survival, it's highest in cohort A with the fusions. When you look at overall survival, again, cohort A with the fusions, you see the highest overall survival. So this was encouraging and led to the FDA approval. And now there's also been for the confirmatory study, because that was accelerated approval, pemigatinib versus gemcitabine and cisplatin, a randomized frontline phase 3 study. There were three randomized phase 3 studies of gemcitabine, cisplatin versus an FGFR inhibitor. It's been challenging to accrue to them because, as Dr. Kelly mentioned, there's a new standard, gemcitabine, cisplatin plus IO. And, of course, there's a small population of patients, but this is the confirmatory study. Now moving on to futibatinib, which is the second FGFR inhibitor that's approved. It's a covalently binding inhibitor. This was the Phoenix CCA2 study. This was a single-arm study. All patients had advanced intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and they had had at least one prior line of therapy that was gemcitabine and platinum-based. Everyone got futibatinib. The one difference here is that futibatinib is given continuously, 20 milligrams every day. There's no one-week break like there is with pemigatinib. The primary endpoint here was objective response rate, and as you can see here, again, a nice waterfall plot with a response rate of 42%. And then it's important to think about also what are the side effects of this class of drugs. Hyperphosphatemia is a common side effect. You can see 85% of patients on this drug had hyperphosphatemia. Why is that? This is an on-target, off-tumor side effect because when we hit FGFR1 and inhibit that, we decrease the excretion of phosphorus in the kidneys and in the gut. And so usually this is not a clinically significant issue for most patients. Unless the phosphorus is above 6.5 or 7, I don't really significantly make major interventions for patients, but there are phosphorus binders, there's dietary changes, making sure people are moving their bowels. These can all help with hyperphosphatemia. We see dry mouth and dry eyes with this class of drugs. We also do see some palmar plantar erythrodysesthesia or hand-foot syndrome, like we do with other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We see also some increase in liver tests. As you can see, the vast majority of these side effects are grade 1, grade 2, and very few are grade 3, grade 4. It's also a confirmatory phase 3 trial for futibatinib in the front line. And this is, again, the key toxicities of the FGFR inhibitors. As mentioned, the key take-homes are watch for hyperphosphatemia. And because some people can get retinal detachment, which can manifest as people having floaters, halos around what they see, a baseline eye exam is important. Relay 4008 is a new FGFR2 specific inhibitor that's been making a splash. This study in patients with FGFR2 fusion or rearrangement positive cholangiocarcinoma showed a nice response rate of over 60%. And when you looked at the patients who were treatment naive and who got the RP2D at 70 milligrams, 82% of people had a response rate. This was in about 15 patients. The more mature data and a larger subset of patients are awaited. And then tiningotinib is another exciting FGFR inhibitor. It's actually a multi-kinase inhibitor that hits FGFR. Dr. Javle is leading a lot of the development of this drug. We see that with this drug, in patients who had previously been treated with an FGFR inhibitor, many of whom have kinase domain mutations, several of them are also getting benefit. And this has led to a phase 3 study, which is the first phase 3 study in patients in the post-FGFR inhibitor setting, where people are getting randomized to either tiningotinib or physician's choice of chemotherapy, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI. So we look forward to potentially having a drug that we can give after either pemigatinib or futibatinib. And then finally, moving on to isocitrate dehydrogenase. This is an enzyme that, if we remember from chemistry from ninth grade, is involved in the Krebs cycle. Isocitrate is converted to alpha-ketoglutarate with this enzyme, IDH1. But when it's mutant, you end up developing this oncometabolite, which is 2-HG. And this can lead to oncogenesis through a variety of pathways. IDH1 mutations are primarily seen in intrahepatic cholangio and rarely seen in extrahepatic cholangio. You can see right here that in about 15 to 20% of patients, you see it intrahepatic, but it's rarely in extrahepatic. And there was a study that led to the FDA approval of evocitinib, an IDH1 inhibitor. And this was a placebo-controlled trial in patients with cholangiocarcinoma who had an IDH1 mutation. They were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to evocitinib versus placebo. The primary endpoint was progression-free survival. This study was positive with a hazard ratio of 0.37. The progression-free survival with evocitinib was 2.7 months compared to 1.4 months in the placebo arm. And crossover was allowed, and you can see it wasn't positive for OS, but again, crossover was allowed. But what's really important also is the 6-month PFS rate and 12-month PFS rate, where it was 32% and 22% with evocitinib, and there were not people in the placebo arm who were progression-free at 6 and 12 months. And then this is a study that was led by Dr. Harding with a new IDH1 inhibitor, LY3410738. This is a covalent inhibitor of IDH1 and IDH2. And it was first in a first-in-human study, but then it was combined with gemcitabine and cisplatin. You can see a nice overall response rate of 46%, but this drug is not continuing development. But the idea here is just that there's multiple efforts going on to target IDH1. The side effects with IDH1 inhibitor evocitinib, it's a very well-tolerated drug. You can see compared to placebo, the side effects are very similar. It's maybe slightly more GI side effects with nausea, diarrhea, abdominal pain with evocitinib, but overall well-tolerated drug. So finally, I will end with just saying that with FGFR2 fusions and IDH1 mutations, these are the only two targets that we have cholangiocarcinoma-specific FDA approvals. You can see here above the line, we have the approvals or standards for biliary tract cancer. Below the line, we have tumor agnostic approvals. And you can see that these are the studies that Dr. Kelly spoke about. We have other IO and tumor agnostic approvals. But in terms of FDA approval in cholangiocarcinoma and biliary tract cancer, we have pemigatinib and futibatinib, and then we have evocitinib, and then we have a series of other targeted therapies that are more disease agnostic. And then our team is going to also talk about trastuzumab deruxtecan, which recently got approved for HER2 altered tumors. Thank you very much. This is what I wanted to share with you about IDH1 and FGFR2.
So before we go on to your cases, and I think somebody else had a case that maybe we could bring up too, and you can call on them as well. But just I want to go to Katie, you know, thinking back to lung cancer, we're kind of joking about, but one of the things about lung cancer, I don't know if you heard of the IPASS study. It was one of the early studies done of targeted therapy where they compared an EGFR, I think it was gefitinib, one of the older ones, to chemo, and the patients did better. And then they did it again with RET. And then they were like, we can't keep doing these randomized trials on these rare things. And they eventually evolved into sort of a approach where if they saw a 40 or 50% response rate to targeted therapy, and the targeted therapy was well, you know, it was well tolerated, which most of them, at least in lung, are, they just bring it into first line. And I guess my question is, first of all, Katie, can you give, you know, for those who don't see that many of these cases, more of a feel for how much bang you get out of these two strategies? Is it comparable? You know, in lung cancer, you see osimertinib, you see most patients respond, they are not cured, but, you know, they respond for a year or a year and a half. Katie, any thoughts about, first of all, are you going to be able to actually get these studies done in the first line? And, you know, sort of globally looking at it in general, do you think patients would be better off with ivosidenib or, you know, futibatinib first line? I know you need the trial, but I'm just curious what you think.
Great question. I think the FGFR inhibitors do have comparable efficacy data that make us think that they might actually come out ahead in first line. If we look at objective response rate, for example, futibatinib is higher than we see with GemCis, Durva, or GemCis, Pembro even. Acknowledging the differences in a phase three trial, we see a little attrition in these efficacy endpoints. In a phase two trial, they tend to be higher, but it's at least in the same ballpark, if not higher. That said, it has been very difficult to get the data in a timely fashion to conduct phase three trials. And unlike lung cancer, you know, our 10% or less population is 10% or less of 10,000 a year, not over 100,000 a year. So we're working with a much, much, much smaller needle in the haystack. And so conducting the first line trials has been prohibitively difficult so far with the rarer targets in the first line, though, again, there are lots of advances in access to profiling, which may change that in the future. I do think one point that I find in my clinic is that GemCis, Durva, and GemCis, Pembro are very well tolerated, and patients feel pretty good on them. And if you're a lucky patient who gets on that tail of the curve, and we don't know yet which people are on that tail of the curve, it's a really nice place to be, like I showed those chemo-free intervals. FGFR inhibitors in general don't have quite the same track record of osimertinib in terms of their PFS. We're still talking less than a year, more like 9 months in the PFS space. And they also have some toxicities that patients don't love. And I find that my patients who have gotten those therapies in the first line and haven't already been through chemo may not like them as much as they like their GemCis Durva. That's been my experience, or GemCis Pembro.
So, Milind, I always think about fellows in the summer because, of course, they come on July 1st. And I'm curious, you know, for a fellow who's never even heard of an FGFR inhibitor and wants to know what are the key things they need to be thinking about when they put a patient on one of these agents, what are some of the main points you bring up?
So interesting. I had a call yesterday from a patient and her physician hadn't used it before, but a lot of these things can be addressed quite easily as long as you have a physician who's willing to work with us. So I mentioned the importance of eye test, retinal exam, like Lipika mentioned, frequent phosphorus monitoring. And I typically do it at least once a week during the first month and sometimes less often after that. And, you know, monitoring them, and I inform them, although this is a oral medication, toxicities can be just as serious as chemotherapy. So they require equal degree of intensity in terms of follow-up and monitoring. And I have some cases to illustrate, Neil, where perhaps they were not monitored as such with harmful consequences.
Interesting. I'm going to ask a similar question to you, Jim. We were just saying, again, you know, July is when all the new fellows come on. What do you say to somebody who's never seen a patient with biliary tract cancer who got an IDH inhibitor is going to get ivosidenib? Bottom line, or what would you say to a fellow in terms of what they need to be thinking about in a patient like that in terms of tolerability?
The one thing, you know, overall, ivosidenib is very well tolerated. It's supported by the clinical data. I do watch for QTC prolongation and drug-drug interactions. So I will monitor EKGs in that space. But in general, I'm not overly concerned with its use. I don't know if my colleagues do anything different.
Well, maybe we can get into that with some of these cases. Why don't we start out with your cases, Lippi?
Sure. So the first one here is a patient that I took care of who's a 37-year-old woman who presented with abdominal pain to the emergency room. And she first had an ultrasound and then went on to have an MRI. And she was found to have a 6.1 centimeter liver mass. And she had a biopsy. This showed intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And luckily, this was the only site of disease that was seen. And she went on to have a resection. And at that time, this was some years ago, capecitabine was not yet the standard, and she went on to get 6 months of gemcitabine and cisplatin. She unfortunately had a recurrence 18 months later, had some liver-directed therapy, then eventually went on to gemcitabine and cisplatin again before the combination with IO was approved. And she was found to have an FGFR2 POC1B fusion. And so there are a couple of things that we did with her, but I was curious with my colleagues, when you have a young patient with an FGFR2 fusion, how do you decide between pemigatinib, futibatinib, clinical trial, versus going on with chemotherapy and doing something like FOLFOX in the second line?
Let's see what Katie says.
I definitely would favor an FGFR inhibitor at this juncture. If the clinical trial is available, that would be the first choice, I think, because we know there's room for improvement. My go-to outside of a clinical trial is probably futibatinib based on the efficacy data in terms of PFS, response rate, and side effect profile as well, I think is similar, if not slightly favorable. That said, I'm curious to hear what others respond.
So, I agree with Lippi.
No, I was just going to say, let's find out what happened with the patient.
So I took care of this patient when we had the futibatinib trial going on. And so we actually invited her to go on this trial, and she did. And she used to drive back and forth from New Jersey to Boston for this trial. And she ended up getting 7 months out of this. And one of the benefits of this was that she had a young son, and she was able to walk her son to kindergarten, which was really a dream for her. And she unfortunately passed away a few weeks later. But the fact that this treatment gave her enough time to be able to make it to September to walk her son to kindergarten was, you know, a real testament to the investment in this field by all the different players here around drug development and cholangiocarcinoma.
So actually, Milind, when we did this webinar just 2 days ago with Tony Staub and John Strickler on HER2 positive GI cancers, including biliary, and the theme was back to school special. And we were talking about, you know, certainly in colorectal cancer, everybody's aware of more and more younger people being diagnosed with the disease. And we were bringing up, this is the week all the kids go back to school right now, the week that we're in right now. And that, you know, the impact on the families of these diseases. And I was curious what we know about earlier onset and early diagnosis of biliary tract cancer, Milind. Is it going beyond colorectal? What are we seeing in terms of younger patients, and if so, why?
So, Neil, we are unfortunately seeing a substantial number of young patients, and I define them as 40, and as I get older now, I'm going to define them as less than 50, biliary tract cancer. I think typically when I see a young patient, I want to find out if they have underlying PSC, ulcerative colitis. There are patients who have DNA damage repair mutations, which there's a higher prevalence in younger patients. And interestingly, like the case that Lippi presented, the FGFR altered cholangio is somewhat enriched with younger patients, particularly young women in the below the age of 40. And I've seen patients who, you know, pregnant with FGFR fusion cholangio. So I don't know if these patients are now being diagnosed as cholangio. And in the past, we refer to them as cancer non-primary. But we are also seeing a higher numbers of younger patients in our practice with cholangio.
So, Jim, any thought? I mean, this patient, your patient was 37 years old, Lippy. That is a young person to be dying of biliary tract cancer. Any thoughts about if this is happening, why it's happening, Jim? I hear people talk about the microbiome in terms of colorectal cancer. Is that relevant here?
I think that's a great research question. Many groups are looking at the early onset population, looking at microbiome, germline genomics, registries to look at potential risk factors. I think it's a question that's going to require a large number of patients and, you know, continued collaborative efforts to understand it. It is an important group where, you know, many, many things need to be considered in the early onset, fertility, you know, mentioned pregnancy and management of that, often people with young families. And most, I think, major cancer centers now have embedded an early onset, you know, support system where we're able to, you know, give patients with these diagnoses that additional support, as well as learn and understand why we may be seeing this.
I just wanted to add also that we talked a little bit earlier about the prevalence of germline HRD mutations, homologous recombination repair defect mutations. And anytime I see a patient who's less than 50 or even older than 50 who's had multiple primary cancers themselves or who has a family history compelling for cancer, we need to be sending these patients for germline testing because we will find a hereditary cancer gene in a subset of them, probably 5-6%, which is similar to other cancers like pancreas even. And so we need to be doing germline testing, particularly in these young patients and particularly in those with a compelling history.
So do you know anything about PARP inhibitors in BTC, Katie?
Right now, there's pretty limited data, but certainly some trials just being launched. There are case reports suggesting benefit in handfuls of patients retrospectively. I think perhaps also a tendency towards better response in platinum therapy for patients with BRCA, et cetera. One challenge, though, is we don't know usually in these large data sets who has true loss of heterozygosity or homologous recombination repair deficiency versus just a single hit mutation. And it's hard to winnow out a signal without both matching sets of DNA to know who's who.
That's a great point. Why don't we bring up, there's another case that Milind has, and now you have a 69-year-old man with cholangiocarcinoma. What happened with him?
So this is a patient who is 69, who presented with abdominal pain. At the time, he also had kidney stone. But during workup for that, he was noted in 2019 to have cirrhosis of the liver, secondary to metabolic associated steatotic liver disease, mast cell, and there was a L3 lesion. So the liver biopsy confirmed cholangio. This was a time when durvalumab was not approved. The patient got gemcitabine and then really for a prolonged duration, almost a year. And he had relatively liver-limited disease, so he had chemo radiation. So my first question to my colleagues is, do you consider consolidative therapy after systemic chemotherapy in patients with, say, for instance, intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, in this patient who really had metastatic disease, limited metastatic disease at presentation? Can I ask you, Katie, to comment?
So by consolidative, you mean radiation of a local area of disease?
Radiation of a local area of disease in the liver.
I have done that after, exactly like you say, a prolonged test of time and biology. And if we see nothing else outside the liver, I have done that. But again, I'm always hoping to see some trial data to support that.
Yeah, so our radiation colleagues at MD Anderson have published some data that suggests that a cause of mortality in a lot of these patients is liver failure, which can be mitigated by liver-directed therapy. Unfortunately, the ABC-07 study was negative in that regard with consolidative radiotherapy, but it was a small study and very small numbers, I think less than 10 or with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma were included. So anyway, this was a time when pemigatinib was approved. Futibatinib was still not approved at that time. So the patient recurred about a few months after completing radiation, and the patient had NGS, which showed FGFR, PAWR fusion, MCL1 amplification. So the patient was treated with pemigatinib and had really a prolonged course of therapy from April 2021 until December 2022. So a good time for disease response and disease stability. The patient progressed after this duration of therapy. So Lipikar, at that time, there was really nothing approved in the second line FGFR space. There was no trial in the second line FGFR space, such as you indicated with tinlarebant. Would you consider using another FGFR inhibitor like furibatinib, or would you go on for chemotherapy?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm so glad your patient got a lot of benefit out of both pemigatinib and now furibatinib. So, you know, when we find an Achilles heel in a tumor, the ideal is to keep on hammering away at it if you can to give a patient prolonged benefit. And we learned this from our colleagues who treat non-small cell lung cancer, where you sequence EGFR inhibitors or sequence ALK inhibitors. So when patients have progression on their first FGFR inhibitor, such as pemigatinib, I always get sequencing. So I do liquid biopsy, or I also sometimes do a tumor biopsy. And then I look for the mechanism of resistance. In many of these patients, they have mutations in the FGFR2 kinase domain, and this leads to resistance to these reversible FGFR inhibitors. Futibatinib, with this unique binding of the cysteine residue and the covalent nature of its binding, it does overcome some of these resistance mutations. And so after pemigatinib, if someone has these resistance mutations, they certainly think about giving futibatinib next. Even with futibatinib, people sometimes develop these kinase domain mutations at progression. And so we certainly need additional FGFR inhibitors, such as possibly tinlarebant, or some of the other sponsors now or have additional next generation FGFR inhibitors. But yes, the sequence of pemigatinib followed by futibatinib, with this patient getting, you know, 3 years plus on an FGFR inhibitor. Kudos to you for your creativity when this wasn't approved in this setting and the patient's doing so well.
Thank you.
No, I mean, these are, these are lung cancer kind of numbers. First line therapy, a year and a half, and then second line therapy, another year and a half. I mean, although in lung cancer now they move towards giving the best, you know, osimertinib is better than the ones before. They would give erlotinib, and then obviously now they just start with the best one, which kind of sounds like what you all are doing anyhow. But I am curious about one thing that just sort of popped into my head as I was listening to this case. Maybe coming back to you, Jim, the entity of sort of, I don't know what you call it exactly, mixed HCC and BTC. Like, is that a real entity? And when you see it, like, what do you do?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a real entity. You know, this is a pathologic diagnosis based on biopsy, where it's a biphenotypic tumor and essentially has histologic features of both intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and hepatocellular carcinoma. I think biologically the cell of origin there is unclear. You see it as a small percentage of both HCC cases and intrahepatic cholangio. I think that with the current evolution of systemic therapy for both biliary tract cancer and HCC, there's a commonality now, at least in the idea of immunotherapy. And I think it's very reasonable in an upfront setting to treat those patients with gemcitabine cisplatin with an anti-PD-1 or L1 antibody. I do think it's very important to genotype those cases because in that setting, you can identify mutations that you might see in intrahepatic cholangio, which would allow continued treatment. I'd say that, you know, the treatment of the mixed HCC cholangio is variable depending on who you speak with. And sometimes people will move actually to a pure HCC type regimen based on clinical, you know, how patients clinically do. Some people re-biopsy at the time of progression. I think it's in general a rare entity, and therefore there's some latitude in the way it's treated. But it's real, and we see it, and often excluded from studies of intrahepatic cholangio or HCC.
Milan, do you want to add anything to what Jim just said? And can you talk a little bit about the images here?
I don't have anything to add to what Jim mentioned. I'm going to talk about the images. So on the left, you see the scan at presentation. As I mentioned, this patient got multimodality therapy. There was a liquid biopsy really based on some of the research that Lipica had presented with actionable mutations, which is why the patient got futibatinib second line and also got microwave ablation in after futibatinib. So our group believes in multimodality therapy, even in the setting of targeted therapy. And this patient continues to do well, and he's a strong advocate for the cholangiocarcinoma foundation.
There's a cholangio foundation. I did not know that. Wow, that is very interesting. There's desmoid, there's everything. As foundations, advocacy groups. All right, let's move on and talk a little bit about IDH1. I think this is more like a theoretical scenario, Lippy, you put together?
Yes, that's right. It's a theoretical scenario. So this is a 65-year-old woman with rheumatoid arthritis that was active, and so she had an immune-related disorder. So this patient got gemcitabine and cisplatin for metastatic intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And then now she has progression of peritoneal carcinomatosis. Her liver function is preserved. Her CA19-9 is low. She has hypercalcemia, and she has a low serum albumin, so even more hypercalcemia than a serum calcium of 12.8. And her molecular profiling showed an IDH1 R132C mutation. So we have different options now in the second line after gemcitabine cisplatin. We have this possibility of considering evocitinib, but then there's also the possibility of considering chemotherapy. So I'm curious to my colleagues, Dr. Harding, what do you think in a case like this? How do you choose between evocitinib versus FOLFOX or FOLFIRI?
Well, I think from the data that you showed, you know, ivosetinib is cytostatic, right? I mean, there's not necessarily a great benefit in terms of tumoral shrinkage. Objective response is about 5%. It's really the tail of the PFS curve. About, 20 to 30% of patients have extended benefit. When you're thinking about cytotoxics, it's a similar response rate. In this case, I think you could certainly do either. I mean, the serum calcium is a bit high there. There's hypercalcemia, especially if you correct for the albumin. There's peritoneal disease, may make an oral therapy more challenging. I think you could argue really in either approach. I tend, though, I might, if the patient is otherwise well, try an oral medicine now, because as time goes on, you may not be able to do that if peritoneal disease gets worse.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jim, because sometimes, all of us on this call have seen patients with evocitinib have more than 1 year, sometimes even more than 2 years on this well-tolerated drug. Yeah, and they're not tied to a cancer center. They can travel the world and do whatever they want because they're on an oral drug. So yeah, and someone who doesn't immediately need tumor kill and cytotoxicity, I certainly also think about using evocitinib.
In general, I prefer targeted therapy to cytotoxic therapy in the second line if there is an actionable alteration. In general, the data, I think, are stronger in some ways, even though, we're dealing with like phase two single-arm studies, with the exception of ivosetinib. I think it's very, very useful to do that.
Some of the other points I wanted to make on this case was, one, the piece about hypercalcemia. There were a lot of case reports of hypercalcemia with cholangiocarcinoma, but we actually did a study looking at hypercalcemia and cholangiocarcinoma overall, and we found that over 30% of patients with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma have hypercalcemia, so it's certainly a complication to look out for. And something that we see in GI cancers in general is that a lot of people have hypoalbuminemia. And at least in the EPIC system that we have at our cancer center, if the serum calcium is within normal range, it actually doesn't turn red, even if someone has a low serum albumin and the corrected calcium is high. So we found that actually if you corrected the calcium, the rate of hypercalcemia was higher than you would think, because with just a normal high serum calcium, it was more like 15 to 20%. But when you correct the calcium, it's over 30% for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And then we also found an association with IDH1 mutations. So patients with IDH1 mutations had a 60% rate of hypercalcemia compared to patients with IDH wild-type cholangiocarcinoma that had a 29% rate of hypercalcemia. So something, an association that came out of that study was this genomic plus hypercalcemia association, which we hadn't seen before. And the other study was looking at the CA19-9, and we see that patients with IDH1 mutations often have a normal CA19-9 like we see in this patient. So sometimes there are little signals of phenotypic associations that are good to know about. Like Dr. Javle was saying, with FGFR2 fusions, we sometimes see that in young patients and especially young women.
Sometimes this reminds me of like Talmudic scholars of cholangiocarcinoma and BTC, because there's so many variables to think about. So Katie, I thought Lippy was going to bring up the fact that she put in the fact this patient had rheumatoid arthritis. So I was going to ask you, in terms of first-line use of IOs in biliary tract cancer, thinking about the potential benefit to the patient, how much autoimmune problems does the patient have for you to skip the IO, Katie?
That's a great point. I actually thought that would be a provocative point to take from this case as well. Noting the TOPAZ-1 data is limited by very small numbers within each little slice and dice basket, it is provocative to see that the IDH1 subgroup had a lower response rate with durvalumab than without. Again, too small of a sample size to draw firm conclusions, but the PFS data sort of mirrored that. The OS data didn't show a clear-cut trend for the mutants. And so when you have a risk on the one hand of worsening rheumatoid arthritis and an unclear benefit in that molecular subgroup from the limited sample size, it makes me, one, want to get bigger sample size, for example, from the KEYNOTE-966 data, which we don't have yet, to say, is this a true signal? And two, say, you know, given the relatively modest benefit in most patients, I probably would omit the immune checkpoint inhibitor in anyone with borderline uncontrolled autoimmune disease. I'm curious to hear what others think, but that would probably be my conservative stance.
I'm curious, Jim, how you think that through. And also, you've seen melanoma everywhere, that people are looking to try to get more benefit out of adding a second checkpoint inhibitor. So many different strategies, particularly a relatively cold tumor, as Katie was saying here. Any strategies that you're excited about, immune strategies beyond checkpoint inhibitors, Jim, that you think are exciting in terms of biliary tract? Mm.
Sure. To the first question about concurrent autoimmunity, I have been more conservative with that. There are emerging data, perhaps in some subsets you might be able to treat somebody with a concurrent autoimmune condition, but that really requires a multidisciplinary management with close follow-up there. In general, for inflammatory bowel disease that's active, I've not done that. There's also some in patients that have had prior transplant. There's a high risk of failure, rejection in that setting, graft rejection. Although people are becoming interested in it and studying it prospectively or in series. Regarding like combo IO and additional therapies, I suspect Dr. Javle will discuss some of that in the emerging component, but anti-CTLA-4 based treatment was actually studied with Gem/Cis/Durva, and it didn't really seem to add much more. And I think really the field is now moving into more of a bispecific space where perhaps co-targeting key regulators such as PD-1, PD-L1, and TIGIT, and others. I think we're going to see that percolate into the field here, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the subsequent lecture.
Milan?
So I want to give some of our experience, Jim and Katie. We had one of our junior colleagues, my junior colleague, Dr. Lee, presented at ASCO GI this year, and a manuscript should be out soon, about experience in treating patients with autoimmune disease, particularly PSC and inflammatory bowel disease. So I want to caution people that this was really a small number. First of all, in terms of the patient, the sample size, he looked at about, 50-odd patients, where, for interestingly, the PD-L1 expression and the TMB seemed to be higher in those patients, although it was a small sample set than what we're used to seeing. And of the patients who actually got immunotherapy along with systemic chemotherapy, as long as they didn't have an active inflammatory bowel disease with ongoing diarrhea and other symptoms, they actually did fine. And I wonder if the concurrent chemotherapy had a mitigating effect on some of the autoimmune effects from the checkpoint inhibitor. But I think this is an emerging area. I wish we can investigate that in a clinical trial setting. But all, you know, there's autoimmune disease and there's autoimmune disease. Some of them are burnt out. Some of them are active autoimmune disease. Some of them are clinically relevant or not. So I think we have to sort of look at each individual case, and the benefit is modest. So we can weigh the pros and cons.
So we're going to move on to talk about HER2 in a second, but one follow-up question, Katie, and one of the things that's often debated, particularly in terms of checkpoint inhibitors, is whether there's a correlation between autoimmune toxicity and treatment benefit. Everybody seems to look at it. I'm not sure exactly what the thoughts are in terms of, for example, biliary tract cancer.
That's a great question. We didn't see that much immune-related toxicity in either TOPAZ-1 or KEYNOTE-966, fortunately. I have not yet seen the correlative analyses looking at that very question, and it may be difficult to ascertain because the response rates weren't dramatically different with the addition of the immune checkpoint inhibitor in this trial. With HCC, we do see a trend towards improved outcomes for patients who had some types of immune-related toxicity, say in the Himalaya trial, amongst others, mirroring what we've seen in other tumor types. So the jury's still out in biliary.
Very interesting. Okay, let's move on and talk about HER2. I've got a bunch of questions that I have for you, just for starters. But first, Jim's going to review what we know about us.
Yeah, thank you so much to the RTP team and Dr. Love for the invitation today. It's always a pleasure to be here and learn from my colleagues. And as stated, we'll talk about HER2-targeted therapeutics. And so we'll really just go through briefly HER2 overexpression in advanced biliary tract cancers, as well as other aberrations. HER2 testing will target some of the clinical data and with some brief conclusions. So, ERBB2 is the gene that incurs the protein HER2. And as we understand this, HER2 is a membrane-bound receptor tyrosine kinase. However, it does not have a known ligand. It binds to one of its three other, so four total ERBs that it would bind with to initiate cellular signaling kind of in a normal state. And that when engaged in these normal physiologic cases, usually leads to signaling through the MAP kinase pathway, the PI3 kinase pathway in TOR, and it's critical for sort of normal cellular development and maintenance across multiple organ systems. In the state of cancer, we know across tumors, there's aberrant HER2 activation, and this can occur by a number of potential mechanisms. The first two that are linked is gene amplification, multiple copies of ERBB2 that then lead to overexpression of the protein HER2, and then a less common alterations such as single nucleotide variants that occur in various intracellular and extracellular domains of HER2 that lead lead to overactivation. This has been shown in models to drive oncogenesis, and in preclinical arena, by blocking this, you can inhibit cell growth. And so it's very well established now that these HER2 alterations are observed across solid tumors. Obviously, the initial experience has been heavily in breast cancer, where HER2 alterations have both a negative prognosis but predictive response to HER2 targeted therapy, so that their outcomes are even better now. But that has moved into gastric and now across tumors, colon, and including biliary tract cancers. We know that amplification and overexpression is more common than single nucleotide variants. We know that this is observed across all anatomic subsets of biliary tract cancer. As was stated earlier, gallbladder cancer tends to have the higher prevalence of HER2 overexpression by IHC or immunohistochemistry is about 20-30% of cases. Less so, but more prominent than intrahepatic is extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, where it's estimated about 10-15%. Intrahepatic cholangio is low, around 2-5%. Here from our data set, when you lump all biliary tract cancers together, this is about seeing at least amplifications, probably 7-10% of cases. And obviously, it depends on the relative contribution of each anatomic subset. The prognostic role, I think, remains somewhat unclear. Some data suggest it would have a worse prognosis here. Others, it's moot. And I think we need more information about that. But it's a clear target and that we really need to focus on and advance the field, as has been done with FGFR2 fusions and IDH alterations. Detecting HER2 in biliary tract cancers is really an emerging and continued field. You can assess HER2 multiple ways. Immunohistochemistry, where you're using an antibody to target the protein and look at its expression on cut slides. And there are various differences between determining HER2 based on the specific histology. So breast cancer is different than gastric cancer. The main difference is in breast cancer, usually it's circumferential expression of HER2 on the surface of the cell. In gastric cancers, probably as well as biliary tract cancers, it's not completely circumferential. It's restricted more to the apical membranes may be very heterogeneous in expression. You can also use in situ hybridization to look for a specific amplification of the gene event, as well as next generation sequencing. The exact and the best approach is still unclear, and I put in the NCCN guidelines, or the most recent version of this, is that it does recommend testing for all patients with unresectable or metastatic biliary tract cancers. But you can see there's a large caveat as to what is the best mechanism to do that. And IHC methods have not necessarily been developed for biliary tract cancers. I think at the highest level, though, many centers are now doing IHC and then reflexing ISH testing, as well as doing next generation sequencing. But there needs to be considerations here, given the paucity of tissue and the need to genotype for all potential alterations. There's also an emerging role for cell-free DNA. It's not a high concordance as with IDH1, but you know, cell-free DNA based on some studies has been concordant about 80% between tumor and the cell-free DNA for HER2 amplification. So it's not as sensitive. In any event, we know this is a target. The biliary tract treatment paradigm continues to evolve, but at this time in the front line, as we talked about, it's chemo immunotherapy, and then largely in the second line, driven by specific molecular alterations. And we'll focus now on HER2 as there are multiple agents in clinical testing. This is a high-level tabulation of some not all of the studies that have evaluated the anti-tumor activity of various agents that target HER2 in biliary tract cancers. Very uncommon are the single nucleotide variants, the tyrosine kinase inhibitor that targets HER2, neratinib, has been tested in a small cohort of patients, and there was some objective response rate there, 16%, modest response rate. But it's interesting to see that for single nucleotide variants, there are some data now that antibody-based therapy, such as with trastuzumab and pertuzumab, or trastuzumab deruxtecan, there may be a response rate there. I think that needs further evaluation and discussion. The main focus has been really on overexpression and amplification. Objective response rates are variable between 20 and up to 40 to 50%. We will go over all of these, some of which are FDA approved, such as trastuzumab deruxtecan in the IHC 3 plus as an agnostic strategy, others which are in NCCN guidelines, such as trastuzumab and pertuzumab and trastuzumab and tucatinib. And so moving along, you know, we'll first focus on trastuzumab deruxtecan, which, as we all know, is an antibody drug conjugate that targets HER2 and carries along with it topoisomerase 1 poison that has had activity across HER2 positive cancers and even in breast HER2 low cancers. And some of the first data that we reported for trastuzumab deruxtecan come from an IIT that was conducted in Japan, where this study search is called the HERB study, H-E-R-B study. It was a phase two study that essentially enrolled patients with HER2 expressing biliary tract cancer. And those patients were pre-screened and HER2 positivity was determined and allowed both HER2 positive and HER2 low. And there were specific definitions for this. And then patients went on to receive trastuzumab deruxtecan at a dose of 5.4 milligrams per kilogram IV every 3 weeks with the primary objective of assessing response rate. And, you know, these patients were screened by a central pathologic examination using both IHC and ISH from archival tissue. HER2 positive was defined as IHC 3 plus or IHC 2 plus with ISH positivity. And then the HER2 low expressing tumors were, as defined here, 0 or 1 plus IHC with no amplification, or as noted here. And so they screened 300 patients here to identify 61 HER2 positive patients by the protocol definition and on 120 with HER2 low expression as depicted on the slide. What you can see here is the tumor response, which was the primary endpoint, confirmed response rate by blinded independent central review. There was an objective response rate in the HER2 positive patients of 36.4% with a disease control rate of 81.8%. There were some CRs. In the HER2 low category, which was a small number of patients, the response rate was lower at 12.5%, and you can see the waterfall plot there, annotating blue for HER2 low and red for HER2 positive. You can see certainly there were some very deep responses. PFS and OS were relatively short at around a median PFS of approximately 6 months. The one the toxicity that I will bring up for trastuzumab deruxtecan, and we'll talk about others, is really pneumonitis and interstitial lung disease that occurred in 8 patients on the trial. 2 patients had grade 5 event. And so this is really a very important potential toxicity of a number of ADCs, including trastuzumab, deruxtecan, and really, you know, when I use this drug, I do really watch very carefully for the potential of this for symptoms related to it, and it's quite critical. The approval of trastuzumab, deruxtecan comes from the Destiny Pan Tumor 02 study. This was a clinical trial was a multi-center, single-arm study of T-DXd or trastuzumab deruxtecan for HER2 overexpressing solid tumors. And the key eligibility here is really an advanced tumor that was not eligible for curative therapy, second line plus, had to have HER2 expression as defined by IHC 3 or 2 plus. You could have local testing to nominate for this study, but then central testing was performed. Prior HER2 targeted therapy was indeed allowed. The cohorts included a number of solid tumors. Each one was to have about 40 patients with a primary objective of confirmed objective response rate by the investigator. And biliary tract cancer was one of these key cohorts. When you move to the efficacy that was initially presented, it's important to see that all patients on the study, which was 267, the objective response rate was 37.1%. For IHC 3 plus, the objective response rate was 61.3%. And this was durable. Median duration of response in that entire cohort was 22.1 months. For the biliary tract cohort, which I've outlined here, the objective response rate for all comers was 22.0%. And when you extracted the IHC 3 plus, it was 56.3%, and no responders in this HER2 intermediate or low setting. And so that is an important theme that I think we're seeing in biliary tract cancers, that it may be the IHC 3 plus that do the best. And this is where the FDA approval is for trastuzumab deruxtecan. I'll comment that trastuzumab deruxtecan is an ADC. And the idea of ADCs was that this would be targeted chemotherapy and it would eliminate toxicities that were similar to cytotoxic therapy. That is not entirely the case. There may be a break off of the chemotherapy warhead, as well as leaching into different tissue in the microenvironment, sometimes called a bystander effect. But you do see cytopenias, which need to be monitored for, as well as GI toxicity. All of these are manageable to a standard oncologist. And overall, it's a quite effective drug for IHC 3 plus solid tumors. Ongoing, although not depicted on a slide, is actually movement of this compound into the biliary tract space in the front line in a global phase 3, which we'll hear more about probably at future meetings. But that will include a comparison to standard of care, as well as in combination with a bispecific antibody. Another compound which remains investigational but is undergoing review by the FDA now is zanidatamab. This is a different mechanism of action, but still designed to target HER2. This is a monoclonal antibody that binds to two distinct sites on HER2. And what's interesting about the molecule is that the antigen binding domains, the length is different. And this allows for a more complex binding of the molecule on the surface of HER2 positive cells that may lead to basically clustering of HER2. And there are a number of proposed mechanisms for its anti-tumor activity. This was studied in an a phase one of all solid tumors. And within that study, there was a subset of patients with biliary tract cancers that were treated, and it was observed there an objective response rate of 40%. And that prompted a global phase two study of zanidatamab in patients with HER2 amplified biliary tract cancers. In this space is slightly different than DESTINY-PanO2. This is biliary tract cancer where there was necessary central confirmation prior to enrollment. They had to progress on a prior gemcitabine containing regimen, but had no prior HER2 targeted therapies. And based on an ISH assay, this, if they were amplified, they were allowed to enter the trial and placed in one of two cohorts. Cohort one was an HER2 positive, which was 2 or 3+ by IHC. Cohort two was IHC 0 or 1+. And the primary endpoint of the study was confirmed objective response rate by an independent central review for cohort one. So this was in the HER2 positive patient population. Secondary endpoints are as listed on the slide. Zanidatamab is given intravenously biweekly at 20 milligrams per kilogram IV. And here, the demographics are listed here. This was an 80-patient study for cohort one. 7 patients were enrolled in cohort two. This is, you know, just a global distribution of patients, typical age, and variable anatomic subsites. The majority of patients had HER2 IHC 75.5%. The majority of patients had, a stage four disease, majority, if not all patients by protocol criteria, progressed on a gemcitabine-based regimen. And here is the waterfall plot from the initial data presentation, indicating that more than 60+% of patients had some degree of tumoral shrinkage. The objective response rate was 41%. You can see color code on the slide, the different anatomic subsites. This was anti-tumor activity was observed in all subsites, and asterisks show the IHC 2+. And in the subset analysis related to response, really there wasn't a difference in outcome based on predefined features, within the exception of the IHC 2+. 2+, the objective response rate was 5.6%. In the 3+, it was 51.6%. So this showed a median duration of response at the first data cut of 12.9 months. And here is a swimmer plot illustrating this. At further data cutoffs, it has increased to about 14+ months. The median time to response was 1.8 months, the median duration of treatment was about 6 months. The PFS is roughly 6 months, still about half the population fall off within that time period. This has prompted a submission to that data to the FDA, and we will wait to hear their response related to an accelerated approval that is set as a date sometime at the end of November. There's an ongoing phase three study that is looking to move zanidatamab into the front line. This study is opened and enrolling presently in the United States, and essentially this is allowing patients with treatment naive intrahepatic, extrahepatic, and gallbladder cancer that must have centrally confirmed HER2 overexpression, either IHC 2 or 3+. Stratification factors are listed, and then patients will receive either GemCis, allowing for an anti-PD-1 therapy, versus this plus zanidatamab. The primary endpoint is PFS in the IHC 3+. Importantly, there are other targeted therapies that are available, trastuzumab and pertuzumab. These are the results from the My Pathways data. Again, similar anti-tumor activity. This is supported by the Tauper study, which was recently evaluated. And then finally, tucatinib and trastuzumab. This is approved in the setting of colorectal cancer. That's HER2 positive, and has NCCN recommendation or evidence for biliary tract cancers. This is using the monoclonal antibody trastuzumab with tucatinib, and this was in a basket study demonstrating, a response rate greater than 40%, median duration of response 6 months, a PFS of, again, about 5.5 to 6 months. And so we're also seeing that there's activity to the combination of HER2 targeted strategies with chemotherapy. As was mentioned earlier, there's data for gemcitabine and cisplatin plus trastuzumab in the frontline setting. This was led by a group at Tata University Hospital in India, enrolled a high number of patients, screened a huge number of patients in a short time, showing, you know, provocative data for anti-tumor activity. And we've also seen data for FOLFOX and trastuzumab in the refractory setting. And so just to kind of comment a little bit on future, you know, things, you know, future avenues for discussion, you know, prognostic factors related to what's the prognosis associated with HER2 targeted therapy? I think still not fully understood. Are there predictive factors to response? Clearly, there's a signal based on HER2 high versus low. There are other potential co-alterations that may mitigate this. This needs to be understood. A subset of patients just do not respond, even though they're IHC3 plus. So what are the innate mechanisms of resistance? Acquired mechanisms of resistance at progression. This is important, not discussed here, but there's been evidence that HER2 may be lost at progression, as well as co-occurring MET amplifications. It's been published by the MD Anderson group, but this still needs to be worked out. Clearly, it's moving into the front line. What are we going to do with a HER2 low set, and how will we access them will be important in the future.
Before we get into your cases, if we could, I just want to fire out a bunch of questions from you from the general medical oncology world, because they've had a lot of experience with anti-HER therapy, so they're coming in with experience and a lot of questions, and I want to just fire through a bunch of them. First, just also reflecting back on your thoughts about HER2 mutant disease, and I was thinking about conversations we've had with Bob Lee at your place in terms of the fact they see HER2 mutant lung cancer and first line therapies, T-DXd is actually approved, although whether that's going to play out in other cancers, even breast, is questionable. Also, the Zani is very interesting in that it's bispecific, but it's hitting, as you said, hitting two parts of the HER2 molecule. Oncologists are familiar with the CD3 immune bispecifics, CRS, et cetera, tarlatamab coming in lung cancer as well. But this is kind of a little bit similar. There's a drug in lung called amivantanab, an EGFR mutant and exon 20, which again hits two parts of the EGFR. Sure. I don't know if you all want to comment on that.
Sure.
Also, we were talking about first line trials. I will say that there is a first line trial of T-DXd in breast and metastatic disease. And as they say, they've closed the books in Las Vegas because nobody is betting on the standard right now. And the thinking is that probably T-DXd will be first line, but we have to see, of course. So I have a bunch of specific questions, but any thoughts so far, Jim?
Well, I think that's a lot to unpack there, and I appreciate that. This is great. So I think I'll go first, and I'm going to ask my colleagues to weigh in as well. But for zanidatamab, you're correct. It's a bispecific, but it's important to acknowledge that it's not a bispecific that we think of when we're targeting an immune effector like CD3 and the specific target. So cytokine release syndrome is not observed with zanidatamab. This is a specific design molecule to target HER2 only, and it does also by the mechanism described. And so you do not see cytokine release syndrome with zanidatamab. The main toxicity of zanidatamab would be infusion-related reactions, which are pre-medicated for, and they're usually grade 1 and 2, diarrhea, also usually low level grade 1 or 2. There is a risk of obviously a decrease in EF, which needs to be monitored, but in general, a tolerable therapy. So it's not the same thing as a bispecific, as you've mentioned. Regarding HER2 missense mutations, I'm curious to know what my colleagues do in that setting. There are a subset of biliary tract cancers that do not appear to be HER2 amplified or have her overexpression, but will have activating mutations in HER2, the single nucleotide variants. Do you use anything for that patient population? Do you refer for study? How do you evaluate that?
Melinda, have you had any patients like that? Have you tried T-DXd?
I think in terms of HER2 mutation, the jury is out. We know about lung cancer. We really don't know a lot about biliary cancer. Dr. Haring has published some data on neratinib. In my practice, I refer them to a trial. I don't prescribe HER2-directed therapy.
Well, let me throw out a few questions that came out the other night in the webinar. I'm going to start with you, Katie. One of the things that we talk a lot about is a sort of a biomarker strategy for, you know, various cancers. And I'm curious, Katie, globally, you know you're going to see a new patient with some form of biliary tract cancer. What are you thinking about priority-wise? What are the most important biomarkers? How are you going to get the information? You know, the faculty the other night went through this an interesting discussion, and also the question of what do you do if you have minimal tissue? How reliable is liquid? Before we kind of get more into HER2, Katie, can you kind of take a step back and talk about your sort of biomarker strategy? And does it vary with geographic site, incidentally?
Great question. So I think we want to get tumor mutation and molecular profiling in general, including HER2 IHC, as Jim alluded to, in all our patients. As a simple answer, we want this answer for everybody. In the absence of data at the time of first-line therapy, I do go ahead and start GemCis plus checkpoint inhibitor while waiting to get it. But I think we want to make sure at minimum that we get a good next-generation mutation DNA-based panel that includes FGFR, either RNA-seq or clear coverage of the FGFR intronic region. So a panel that clearly knows that they're looking for FGFR fusion. So that's top priority. We also want to make sure we are getting mismatch repair or microsatellite instability data, because we don't want to miss that 2% or so that might be MSI high. Those patients actually sometimes could arguably be treated with just Pembro alone. And I've done that because they have such a high response rate. The simple ones to get are things like BRAF mutations that do quite well with BRAF inhibitors and are easy to pick up either on cell-free DNA or just a standard NGS panel. And then the very low likelihood, but, you know, NTRK fusions and things like that, we want a comprehensive NGS panel, not to miss those less frequent but highly actionable targets. You mentioned the anatomic site, and I just want to comment on that for a second, because we know from data that we've done in a small study here at UCSF, as well as just anecdote, that it's much easier to get these results from intrahepatic tumors or patients who've had prior resections. The locally advanced hilar and distal cholangiocarcinomas can sometimes be just relegated to cytology and are very hard to get adequate tissue. And so those people, I get cell-free DNA in parallel. If I know it's only an ERCP sample, I will send a cell-free DNA test at the same time, because there's greater than 50% chance that an ERCP sample is not going to be diagnostic on an NGS.
But I want to bring up a couple other questions, Lippy, that I wanted to run by you, because I was not aware of it, and I just want to see whether you're on the same page. So one of the questions, and Jim alluded to this in his talk, that we get from oncologists is on the NGS assays, you get amplification. And the general oncologists are used to looking at FISH for HER2 and CEP17 ratio, looking for a ratio of 2. And yet what we brought out was that when you look at amplification on NGS, the number is 6. Is that the way you see it? And is that the bar you see? And is that the way you look at amplification? That's my first question, Lippy. The second thing that came out the other night that really surprised me, because I'd heard about this with colon, and this faculty said they feel it's true for biliary, was the role of RAS status and RAS mutations in selecting anti-HER therapy. What they stated was that they generally don't use sort of metabolic type anti-HER therapy like trastuzumab, pertuzumab, tucatinib in patients who have RAS mutations, because the same principle, at least the way they explained it to me, of ligand independent activation you see with EGFR, where they get RAS mutations, then they don't respond to EGFR antibodies. So first, can you clarify this issue of how do you interpret the amplification reported on NGS? And secondly, if you do have a patient who's HER2 positive but also has a RAS mutation, what they were saying was they generally go to T-DXd because it's really targeted chemo as opposed to kind of a metabolic target. So I don't know if this all kind of makes sense, but that's sort of what I was hearing, Lippi. Can you respond?
Yeah, sure. So with the amplification, I generally follow the guidance of the assay that I'm ordering. So in terms of what's designated as HER2 amplified on Foundation Medicine, Tempus, Caris, internal institutional assays, and yes, six copies is often what they designate, but I really go by what the cutoff is for those assays and how they define it. On the second question, I will actually defer to some of my colleagues who treat a lot more HER2 amplified biliary than I do on that one.
Let's go to Katie. What about this thing of coexisting RAS status?
Gosh, I mean, I think that having a separate driver that acts downstream or could interfere with activity upstream is certainly relevant. I don't think I know the data yet in biliary tract cancers with maybe Jim might know for sub-analyses from any of the Zanny data.
So that's still ongoing. So we don't have that data. This is a known issue with HER2 targeted therapy and RAS. There may be a number of co-occurring mutations that may not respond as well. I think that still needs to be better delineated, honestly. Milind, what are your thoughts?
It's actually rather uncommon. I mean, as you know, Jim, the HER2 amplification commonly occurs in gallbladder cancer, where RAS mutations are very uncommon. You know, 20%, less than 20%. We have treated several of these people on trial. I don't think I've seen anybody who has HER2 amplification with RAS mutation. But I think we'll have to wait for the Zanny data to come out, and as well as the data from the Destiny trial. My concern here for you is here really for the group is the timing of HER2 testing. You know, for instance, in the some of the studies presented earlier, people could have had prior HER2-directed therapy, and archival specimen was allowed as long as they had enough tissue for central testing. Do you think that could influence the results, Jim, if somebody had, say, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, or something like that before?
Well, I think yes. I mean, if somebody has had prior HER2 targeted therapy, they're actually in some subset analyses or cell-free DNA from the study of trastuzumab plus tucatinib, sometimes at progression HER2 amplification was lost. Now that's cell-free DNA, that doesn't, I mean, it's not saying that it's not present, but we know from gastric cancer that at progression a subset of people will lose HER2 amplification because it does appear that in gastrointestinal malignancies, the heterogeneity of HER2, there is heterogeneity, intratumoral and even intertumoral heterogeneity. And so I think that that could be a problem. It's possible you could treat patients that were HER2 overexpressed at the beginning, but they might have lost that in that clone.
Neil, I was going to address that question about KRAS as well and just say I think it's also somewhat mechanism of the agent dependent in that I don't know that it would be as relevant for an ADC like trastuzumab deruxtecan where
exactly,
we're delivering a
exactly.
chemo payload. And I don't think we know enough with the mechanism of a unique bispecific as Zanny, but that might be more relevant theoretically.
No, that's exactly what Tony and John were saying the other night, that that's what they think about TDXD if there's a RAS mutation, exactly for the reasons that you described. We can talk about HER2 all day long, of course, but I want to make sure we also deal with new agents and particularly agents of excitement. I'm really curious about the MDM2 story as well. Melinda, if you could talk with us a little bit about some of these new strategies.
Thank you very much, Neil. I am going to discuss novel targets at biliary tract cancer. And for the sake of time, I'm going to focus on two, that is MDM2 amplification and MTAP loss. I'm going to start out with a case. This is a 41-year-old male who presented to the ER with abdominal pain. It was a right lower quadrant pain, and he went to the ER, and it was felt that he had an appendicitis, and he underwent a appendectomy. At that time, he was actually found to have a T4N1 tumor involving the serosal surface of the appendix. The histopathology of the tumor suggested that it was CK7 positive, CK20 negative, CDX2 negative. The other immunohistochemical markers were negative. Can I start with a question for the group? In this case, this patient had this appendiceal cancer, but you know the immunohistochemical pattern was somewhat odd. Katie, would you consider any additional treatment at that stage, like additional chemotherapy or adjuvant therapy?
I think if it were truly an adenocarcinoma and not just a mucinous lesion, I would do what it looks like you've done with post-op adjuvant FOLFOX, extrapolating from colorectal.
Thank you. So this patient was treated at an outside facility and the patient got FOLFOX. The prior imaging was sort of non-specific in the liver, but then the subsequent imaging, which was obtained about 6 months after completion of adjuvant therapy, this was obtained because the patient started having right upper quadrant pain. And on the top, you can see a mass abutting the gallbladder that was involving the liver. And this mass was FDG avid. At that hospital where the patient was admitted, they decided to undergo, perform a hepatectomy, removal of the lesion in the segment 5 and cholecystectomy. This time the pathologies actually suggested it was a gallbladder cancer, T4 and node positive, the pathology of the appendix and the gallbladder were compared. It seemed like it was the same tumor with metastases in the appendix. Can I ask you, Lippi, would you consider systemic chemotherapy at this time?
Yeah, certainly. If we think that appendix tumor was a metastasis and now you're seeing the primary in the gallbladder, this patient probably has a high predilection for recurrence, especially with a T4 tumor. So certainly would think about being aggressive if the patient was interested in this, especially in a 45-year-old, and give postoperative therapy.
So this patient was treated in the S1815 era when the study was going on and was treated off protocol at another facility with GEMSYS and nab-paclitaxel, had a relatively reasonable period of disease control. But 6 months after completion of this therapy, you see a portocaval node. So meanwhile, we got at this time the patient was seen at our center, and then we had an NGS, which showed microsatellite stable disease, IDH2R172 mutation, MDM2 amplification, and PIK3CA. So this was a portocaval node with MDM2 amplification. So I'm going to discuss now the treatment with targeting the MDM2 pathway. As we know, TP53 is one of the most commonly mutated genes in human cancers. As many as 50% of tumors are P53 mutated. And in the presence of cellular damage or injury, the presence of intact TP53 leads to either DNA repair or apoptosis, and therefore it is a cellular protective mechanism. MDM2 is a negative regulator of TP53, and in the presence of amplification or overexpression, it inhibits the P53 pathway and therefore prevents apoptosis and leads to cellular proliferation. So it's been quite remarkable that it's really, this discovery has been not that long, a couple of decades, and it has represented an important target of therapy. So these are the cancers with MDM2 amplification. And as you can see, the most common one is liposarcoma, where as many as 64% of tumors have MDM2 amplification. Biliary certainly features high there. Gallbladder cancer, as many as 12% have MDM2 amplification. Less commonly seen in cholangiocarcinoma in about 5%. And then a smattering of others, such as including adenosquamous of the lung, where it's relatively higher frequency. So this comparative study looked at MDM2 amplification between Western patients here at MD Anderson and in Asia, and showed that the frequency of this mutation is relatively similar in biliary tract cancer, about 10% here in gallbladder cancer. But certainly the prevalence is higher in Asia, because just simply the numbers of gallbladder cancer are much higher in particularly East and Southern Asia. So these are some of the small molecule inhibitors which are targeting the MDM2 TP53 pathway, which are later in development in hematological malignancies and solid tumors. The one that has been investigated in biliary tract cancer is BI-907-828 or Brigham-Madelin, which has been investigated in a phase 1 study, both as a single agent or in combination with immunotherapy. So why immunotherapy? It has been well described, for instance, that MDM2 amplification causes decreased natural killer cell activity, decreased in CD4, IL-2, and interferon gamma signature, has been associated with MDM2 amplification, and its inhibition with inhibitors or antibodies has resulted in stabilization of STAT5 pathway and activation of CD8. So therefore, it seemed intuitive to combine MDM2 inhibitors along with immune checkpoint inhibitors. So this was the first phase 1 trial that was published in Cancer Discovery last year with Brigham-Madelin in patients with advanced or metastatic solid tumors that were refractory to therapy. As you can see, the bars in the red were with MDM2 amplification, and certainly there seems to be activity seen there. Several of these patients had liposarcoma and some had biliary tract cancer, and that led to subsequent trial. So the Brightline 2 trial was a phase 2 trial with an expansion cohort. It has several arms. It includes pancreatic ductal cancer, lung adenocarcinoma, and bladder cancer. But really the main arm that was investigated was biliary tract cancer with 30 patients. And after interim futility analysis, 60 additional patients were to be enrolled in the trial. This trial is enrolled quite rapidly, particularly in Asia. These are some of the preliminary data with the Brightline 2 trial. And these trials refer to with single agent as well as with the immune checkpoint inhibitor, ezamenlimab, which is a patented immune checkpoint inhibitor being developed in this setting. As you can see, partial responses were seen. So this is the schema for both the trials. That is the which included Brigham-Madelin and ezabenlimab combination therapy. It was a multi-arm trial, and it included sarcomas, which was the main arm being investigated, and then other tumor types. There was also the combination arm, as I mentioned earlier. Several of these arms have completed accrual. These were the toxicities associated with this therapy. The main toxicity associated is GI, including nausea and emesis, and it's followed by myelosuppression, particularly thrombocytopenia, which is relevant in our patients who have received, for instance, prior Gemcitabine. Comparison in the combination has revealed relatively similar results, and it seems to be fairly well tolerated in the combination setting along with the immune checkpoint inhibitor with no added toxicity. This slide shows the preliminary activity with monotherapy that you see in the light green with Brigham-Madelin and the combination therapy with Brigham-Madelin plus ezamenlimab. As you can see, partial responses have occurred. In some cases, some of these responses have been sustained. These are preliminary data, and we hope to get final data subsequently, both with this study and with other agents. So clearly MDM2 amplification in the presence of TP53 wild type is an actionable target in biliary tract cancer with gallbladder cancer and cholangiocarcinoma. MDM2 inhibitors have shown some promising initial activity at the expense of relatively modest toxicity. Combination of inhibitors with immune checkpoint inhibitors and perhaps systemic chemotherapy are options in the future, and we await completion of the ongoing trials and presentation of the completed trial results. The next pathway I'm going to talk about is MTAP loss. So MTAP loss, this represents a somewhat different way of targeting, unlike all the other agents that we have discussed earlier, where the activation of the gene and the protein product is being targeted. In this case, the protein is lost. So the only way to inhibit this is indirectly with a synthetic lethal mechanism. So the MTAP gene is located on this cluster called 9P21, where you have CDKN2A and CDKN2B and MTAP located on the same gene. So co-deletions are common. So when you see CDKN2A A and B loss, often think of MTAP loss because this is not commonly reported in current NGS panels. MTAP is a tumor suppressor, which is deleted in several cancers and is an emerging therapeutic target. So going back to biochemistry, I don't want to dwell on this too much, except to mention that MTAP plays a role in methionine salvage pathway. So S-adenosine methionine, as you know, is an important donor of the methyl group through arginine methyl transferase, which is PRMT. So I'd like you to focus on some of these proteins. That's PRMT, MAT, which is the protein which is responsible for methionine to S-adenosyl methionine, and MTAP, which is responsible for regeneration or the methionine salvage pathway. Now, closely linked is the folate cycle. So you may imagine that if you want to target this pathway, there may be some indirect mechanism, including folate cycle inhibition. So this is the really mechanism of synthetic lethal targeting of MTAP loss. So in the presence of intact MTAP, PRMT5 or the arginine methyltransferase targets the methyl group from the SAM to protein. So it's really the most important methyl donor. On the other hand, in the presence of MTAP deleted cell, there's accumulation of MTA, which results in inhibition of PRMT5 and inhibition of transfer. So this is therefore a potential opportunity for synthetic lethal effect using PRMT5 inhibitors. When you give PRMT5 inhibitors in the presence of MTAP loss, this results in synthetic lethal effect and therefore inhibition of methyl transfer. What is the mechanism of immune suppression with MTAP loss? So what you see here is MTAP loss is associated with suppression of T cell proliferation. And this therefore results in an immune suppressive effect. And there are certainly very provocative data and provocative papers, some from MD Anderson, that have shown that presence of PRMT inhibitors may restore the immune microenvironment of the tumor. So the prevalence of MTAP loss, as you can see, is quite high in mesothelioma, an area of great unmet need, and pancreatic cancer, where CDKN2A deletion is relatively common. In terms of biliary tract cancer, MTAP loss occurs about 15%, almost the same incidence of CDKN2A or CDKN2B loss. So this is certainly an important target with a real frequency that we see in biliary tract cancer. So we looked at differences between MTAP loss and wild type in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So this is a slide to show that when you have CDKN2A loss, there's almost a 98% chance that there may be loss of MTAP as well. The other genes that may be altered in presence of MTAP loss are telomerase, TERT, MYC, and several others. On the other hand, MTAP loss is not associated with that alteration in TMB, but there is a lower frequency of TMB high or MSI high with MTAP loss as compared to wild type. Again, going with the theme that MTAP loss is associated with suppression of the immune microenvironment. As I mentioned earlier, the methionine salvage cycle and the folate cycle are closely linked. So could you then exploit antifolate therapy? So there's some interesting work from MD Anderson, which showed that pemetrexed, that is a folate inhibitor approved in lung cancer may have a role in MTAP loss or 9P21 loss cancers. Additional areas of targeting in this case would include PRMT5 inhibitors and as well as immune checkpoint inhibitors in combination with PRMT5 inhibitors. So these are additional targets for therapy, combination therapy, along with PRMT5 inhibitors. So our group looked at MTAP loss in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. This was associated with reduced TILs and a poor survival. Again, going with the theme that immune microenvironment suppression may be associated both with prognosis and as a potential target for therapy. These are the classes of drugs targeting MTAP loss. As I mentioned, they are PRMT5 inhibitors or arginine methyltransferase inhibitors, MAT inhibitors, which are responsible for conversion from homocysteine to S-adenosyl methionine. So these are potential areas, as well as a novel area includes enzymatic replacement, actually replace MTAP with pegylated MTAP. So these are a series of cases, one including gallbladder cancer, which was one from our clinic, a patient who had presented with locally advanced gallbladder cancer, had been treated with gemcitabine and cisplatin and durvalumab, had MTAP loss, and then was treated with the PRMT5 inhibitors, in this case MRTX1719, and had a prolonged stable disease for 10 months. So in summary, MTAP loss in biliary tract cancer is a target. Prevalence is 15%. It may be even higher in extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. We really don't know because samples are often hard to obtain in that setting. While CDKN2A or B deletion is not targetable, MTAP loss represents a unique synthetic lethal target with PRMT5, MTA, and MAT2A inhibitors. And then there is a role of resistance in checkpoint inhibitors. So there's a potential also for antifolate therapy for MTAP loss. And phase 1 and 2 studies are ongoing. Thank you very much.
So I think we've kind of come to the end of our game here today. It was really great. I learned so much from the four of you, and I really appreciate your working with us on this program. And again, thank you so much. It's been an exciting and very, very informative afternoon. Thank you so much and have a great day. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Striving for Consensus, Optimizing the Current and Future Management of Patients with Biliary Tract Cancers.